Thank you to Wildcare and Wildlife Acoustics for sponsoring the Bat Chat podcast.
Can you hear that? We can. Wildlife Acoustics creates the world's leading bat acoustic monitoring tools, designed to help scientists make impactful discoveries for our biologically diverse planet, turning this into this. Visit wildlifeacoustics.com to learn more.
Wildcare are committed to supporting the ecology industry and are specialists in supplying a large range of monitoring, conservation and habitat management products, as well as equipment hire and service and repair. With a large range of products coupled with friendly and expert help and advice, Wildcare is a favourite supplier for ecologists nationwide. Go to wildcare.co.uk to see the full range and quote BatChat at the checkout for 10% off all bat detectors and bat boxes. Hello and welcome to Bat Chat from the Bat Conservation Trust, the leading charity in the United Kingdom solely devoted to the conservation of bats and the landscapes on which they rely. This podcast is for anyone who loves bats. We bring you stories straight to your headphones from the world of bat conservation and from the people out there doing work that furthers our understanding of these magical creatures. I'm Steve Rowe. Professionally, I'm an ecologist, and in my spare time, I'm a trustee of the Bat Conservation Trust. You can join the conversation online using the hashtag BatChat. That's all one word. This week, we've a bumper episode for you, and it's actually our last in this current series, but don't panic, we have some news on that for you later in the show. This week, we're sitting down with Dr. Robert Stebbings. We heard about Bob in the very first episode of BatChat from Shirley Thompson, who mentioned he was involved in the TV episode Bats Need Friends at the end of the first ever National Bat Year in the late 1980s. Bob now lives in Northamptonshire, and it was last summer when I met him at his house. After catching up over a coffee, we sat down in the conservatory overlooking his garden, and I asked him how it all started.
So if we'll start from the beginning, I mean, you were 12 when you became interested in bats. I was exactly 10 years old when I was first invited to join a Cambridge University group that had got interested in studying bats at Bury St Edmunds, Suffolk, which is where I was born and bred. And I was taken underground on the 2nd of January 1952, and I was shown how to identify the bats that were in the chalk mines near Bury St Edmunds. And I was then shown how to ring bats on that first visit, and I was ringing bats from the 2nd of January 1952.
At the age of 10?
At the age of 10. 10 wow. And 2 months. And the chap who taught me was a chap called Owen Gilbert, who was a soil scientist who worked for the Nature Conservancy in Merlewood in Cumbria. So he didn't often visit Bury St Edmunds. So we corresponded and telephoned each other occasionally, and I carried on going underground by myself, winter after winter, visiting the site and ringing bats and recovering ringed ones and finding new ones and so on and so forth. And by 1957, I discovered that the activities that, well, I didn't really realise it at the time, but this was subsequently, I realised that what I was doing was disturbing bats and causing them to avoid being caught. And so in 1957, we wrote a paper about the results, and that was published in the Zoological Journal of the Zoology Society. And basically, it said that the number of bats in any hibernating location was determined by the amount of disturbance they had. Now, I used to go about once a month through the winter, so starting in September through to April. At the same time, I was looking at research papers published in the Netherlands, particularly, where bat work, ringing bats, had started in the 1930s. And they had come by 1957 to the conclusion that they too were causing the decline of bats in the places they were looking. But I was also looking at colonies of bats in areas which had been written about in the zoological literature over the previous two centuries. everything from Gilbert White talking about the noctual bats in Hampshire, where he lived, and also the noctual bats that lived around the west side of Bury St Edmunds, which used to number, say, 300 or 400 noctuals in an eyeful, just flying above my head, feeding on summer chafers. They're the smaller version of the cockchafer. And there were just clouds of them. Now, by 1960, when I left Bury St Edmunds to start my official work, my full-time work, those bats had disappeared all but. I'd only see a few. And I've been back several times over the last 40, 50 years, and there are very few noctuals flying any time in the summer in that part of the country. Mm. So you're going from a population that must have numbered many hundreds down to close to zero now. In the same sort of period, I started work at Firsborough Research Station in Dorset, which was an 1884 Victorian house with hollow walls and several different sections to the roof. And within a short space of time, although I was a botanist, supposedly, I used to go into the roof spaces at lunchtime, and I found 9 British species of bats living in that roof. So that was grey long-eared, brown long-eared, Dorbentons, occasional whiskered, very occasional natras, mouse-eared bat. Now, mouse-eared bat, as you may realise, was very rare at the best of times in Britain. What I did do, though, I did discover in surveying big houses in the Isle of Purbeck, I did find where it had been breeding for a number of years. I found a huge pile of droppings in a big building, which also had greater horseshoes as a nursery colony, which was exterminated in 1953, but I didn't discover it until 1961. But because greater horseshoes lived in the area, and I was aware that the numbers had gone down substantially just by talking to local people. And so then I got really interested in working on the Greater Horseshoe, not only in Dorset, but across Britain, and did discover that the numbers had declined from, say, 150 to 200,000 down to less than 15,000 at the time I was doing this work. I mean, this is sort of condensing 25 years' work. And pesticide poisoning, timber treatment in buildings, was one of the principal causes. So more and more, I was getting drawn into looking after these bats throughout Britain. And there was a chap called, well, Roger Ransom, who was working in Gloucestershire around Stroud. And his area sort of went down into the Mendips and more latterly across to the Forest of Dean, that sort of area. So he worked on that colony from the late 50s right through, well, he's still working on it. In the case of Wales, the work was, well, a chap called Tom McCowart. I met him on his honeymoon on a boat to Rum. And I was working on the size clines in pipistrelle bats across the whole of the UK. And I had discovered that there were bats on Rum, so I went up there on the 17th of June 1971 in order to catch a sample of the colony living on Rum. And on the boat going over there, I just happened to meet Tom McCowart and his wife Rena, and he was basically an artist. He'd been working for Cumbernauld Council as a sort of trainee illustrator artist. And then shortly afterwards, he moved to South Wales to do an art course at Carmarthen Art College. And this was 1972, 73, that sort of period. And he kept writing to me saying he was interested in caving, basically. Mm. And he kept writing to me saying he'd found greater horseshoes hanging in various places, you know, mines, caves, just odd ones and twos. And so in 1975, we visited all these sites and we started putting rings on them, and he recovered them in different places. And then there was one day, end of 1975, October, there were two botanists working at Stackpole on behalf of the Nature Conservancy, as it still was in those days. And they said they were staying in the stable block at Stackpole House, as was, and they discovered a chap. He was killing bats coming out of the roof of this house, or the stable block, and one of the bats they picked up and had a ring on it. That ring then was given to the assistant regional officer, warden in the Nature Conservancy, a chap called Stephen Evans. A month or more later, that ring got to me, and I said, "Eureka!" And it turned out to be the main breeding site for the greater horseshoe in southwest Wales. I say main because subsequently we discovered lots of different places. But it was then, through lots of evidence that we investigated, we discovered there must have been at least 15,000 killed at the time in 1962 when the building burnt down due to a... It was a dust fire, basically, an explosive fire. And as a result of all that, we talked with all the locals who had lived there, and they used to say, well, we used to walk home in the woodlands near there, and bats were constantly bumping into us. You know, greater horseshoes, that they were so thick in the air, you couldn't avoid being hit by them. So we started doing a series of pub talks. Saturday night, we'd set up a screen in a pub. We went round all the local area, and I'd talk, you know, in the pubs about bats, really wanting to get local people to come to us saying, well, we know where bats are and where they used to be and all that. So we got a huge amount of information like that. And it was surprising how much crept out of the woodwork, as it were. And so we gradually built up a very big picture of the whole of West Wales, and Tom McCowart has really sort of brought it all to life and managed to get the sites protected, but he did a tremendous amount of work on it. So that was another episode which is so important for the bats of West Wales. I mean, it wasn't just the Greater Horseshoe. When I was doing surveys in West Wales, I came across the first records for Ceratine bats. And then on one of the courses I used to do at Oralton Field Study Centre, I went up into the roof to show people what we look for in roofs and how to survey for bats and so on and so forth, one of the regular courses that I used to do. And I said, oh, that's interesting, that bat up there in the roof, that's an Enthusiastes pipistrel. And that was the first Enthusiastes for Wales. I had found the first for Britain in 1969 in Dorset, in the house, the research station that I first studied in. And in that particular case, I happened to be with the senior officer for the research station. And I was just taking him around to show him all the different places I found bats. And there was a ridge tile with a little tiny hole in it. And I looked up and looked in the hole with a torch. Couldn't see a face or anything. And I said, oh, that's a bat that's new to Britain.
Just, as you do.
As you do. And it took us 2 days to actually, got it out of the hole. And then it took 2 days to really confirm what it was, because we didn't have all the books and things with us at the time.
I was going to say, yeah. Where do you go for that sort of...
Yeah, so we did measurements and all that. So that got published in Nature, actually, this scientific journal, as a new record for Britain. And I should say that when I first started studying bats in Britain, the species list was just 12. And now it's, what, 17, 18, who knows? new ones turn up.
Yeah.
So my life really has been principally looking at the rare endangered species. The horseshoe work got published in a number of different places. But during the late 1960s, I was getting increasingly concerned that bats were still being killed needlessly. And the thing which changed everything was European Conservation Year, which was 1970. Now, before 1970, all the telephone calls I used to get were, "I've got bats, how do I get rid of them?" Well, I did a lot of broadcasting, radio and television, through the 1960s, and I did an intensive amount during 1970 because all the other species were being highlighted across Europe that needed protection. And I jumped on the bandwagon and said, what about bats? Because nobody else was interested in bats across Europe. After 1970, I used to get telephone calls then saying, we've got bats, we know we mustn't kill them, but how can we get rid of them? So the whole tone of telephone calls changed in that 1 year. Now, Lord Salisbury, who is a botanist, he had got an act in Parliament that was beginning to take shape, which was to protect endangered species of plants, wild plants. And a friend of mine at the time, who was president of the Mammal Society and of the Suffolk Naturalist Society, Lord Cranbrook, I said, look, we need to get bats protected. Oh, can't do that. Their lordships won't like having bats protected. What can we narrow it down to? Because their lordships like animals with big eyes and nice cuddly things. They don't like the idea of bats. So we gradually worked it up. The Wild Creatures and Wild Plants Act of 1975 included the mouse-eared bat and the greater horseshoe. And also that ringing bats, which we had already shown was harming bats through disturbance, we'll put marking bats on it as well. And Cranbrook said, well, they'll probably accept that. Sure enough, by the end of 1975, that act was law. And so the mouse-eared, which was effectively extinct anyway, and the greater horseshoe were protected, as well as meaning that anyone wanting to ring bats had then to get a license. So I was employed by the Nature Conservancy to organise the ringing of bats and licensing and all that sort of thing. But that wasn't good enough for me. So after the 75 Act, we then were greatly encouraged in Britain by a chap called Jack Creighton, Lord Creighton. He was Secretary of State for Scotland. He really got interested in bats, and he had much more power in government, having been a minister. And we had a number of meetings in Parliament. I gave talks to different groups of MPs and lordships in Parliament over 2 or 3 years. And eventually the Wildlife and Countryside Act 1981 was developed and passed. And there was a huge amount of anti-stebbings at the time in the press. And even hit the Washington Post as being a pariah of conservationists. Quite fun, really, in some some respects. It didn't really hurt. I was just annoyed.
What was it that sort of inspired you to get a bat group set up? You know, what was the process of it? And how enthusiastic were people to actually get those groups set up, really? Because some of those predate BCT, don't they?
We are delighted to say that we've once again been selected by the Big Give for this year's Green Match Fund, which means every donation we receive will be doubled. This time around, we're raising funds for our science and research work, and we're hoping to raise £10,000, and the Big Give would match each donation made. Donations must be received via the Big Give website, which will go live on the 18th of April and will remain open for 1 week only until the 25th of April. Every donation will make a difference. We've put a link to the donation page in the show notes.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. There was John Goldsmith in Norwich, sort of Norfolk back group, but one man. He started, he was going in the 1960s. He died, of course, a couple of years ago. And then in the 70s, is it Paul Richardson?
Phil Richardson.
I beg your pardon. So in the 70s, I mean, he was interested in mammals as well as bats. And he sort of floated more towards bats by sort of 1980-ish. So he had started early on. At London Bat Group, they were quite early with Tony Hudson. But what I was concerned about, I mean, as I was working full time on bats, it was, if you like, I had the time to be able to develop these groups. And I thought, well, what we need is county bat groups, you know, not just the odd ones, but all the counties. And so I started doing courses in different counties in early 1980s, just when the Act had come into place. So I'd give talks to council officers, which often included local naturalists and people that the council already knew. And then individual counties came up with a bat group. And a lot of people then came to the various courses that I was running in different places around the country, most noticeably Preston Montfort in Shropshire and the Oralton Field Study Centre in West Wales. They were always sort of oversubscribed by people wanting to go on the courses. And then I'd give individual courses up and down the country.
I mean, you mentioned some great names there. I mean, when I was getting into bats, we'd go on holiday to various places, to North Norfolk or Devon and Cornwall. And we'd been in the bat group for a couple of years, and we were going on a family holiday to Norfolk, and we'd said to some people on the committee, we're like, oh, we're going to Norfolk. Have you got any good places to go? And people said, oh, my trainer was John Goldsmith. I'll give you his email address. Dropped John an email, and John replied straight away and said, yeah, I'm not here that week, but if you go, if you phone this lady, Sue Parsons, she's doing work at Paston Great Barn. Phoned Sue. She was like, yeah, I'm doing a count next week, you know, come along. Here's where to go. Here's a grid reference. And, you know, she was so enthusiastic. Took me inside Paston Barn to see, you know, these 40, 50 barber stalls.
Nice barn, that, isn't it?
Yeah, really
nice. As long as you haven't got to pay for the repair of the roof.
And it was just so nice to have people who were so enthusiastic to get people involved and enthused, really. You know, I think those experiences really did sort of keep me going to doing what I'm doing now. What do you think are going to be the challenges for bat conservation in the future?
Well, again, the watering down and amateurishness of Natural England. The focus on species conservation has dropped, which in one sense is okay if you're maintaining habitats in the way that they, or recreating habitats, rewilding, of course, is the in buzzword, I suppose. But when I was young, you know, I'm talking about 1950s particularly, you'd go out of an evening and almost wherever you were, there would be clouds of bats flying around. In the late 70s, I was able to show through national surveys that I started, which is being continued by BCT, I was able to show huge declines happening very quickly, which was principally due to climate. Bad weather at the wrong time, you know, so the young of the year couldn't be fed by the mothers because they couldn't get enough food to feed them. And then, of course, it takes years for the numbers to rebuild afterwards. And they never do rebuild because by that time, habitats have changed.
Now, we'll come back to Bob's interview in a minute or two, but one of our listeners has written a poem about bats. Helen Ball from Staffordshire Bat Group has actually appeared in Series 2, Episode 20, when I joined her underground on the search for hibernating bats. So if you've not heard that, do go and listen to it after this episode. Helen's poem is narrated by Morgan Brind, who recently co-hosted the BCT Batty Awards for Talented Achievement. This is Nightwinged.
We share this fleeting moment as day and night divide, and colours dim and soften, awakening dulled eyes. Elemental movements ebb at the periphery of my sight, shape-shifting into darkness, aware of shortening light. As it passes from shadow to shadow, Dark against darkening sky, its deafening calls of silence go unheard by the passerby. Images wane and flicker with every swoop and dart and dive, skeins of movement pieced together, falling through starlight. If I gleaned you from the heavens, held you fast and tight, would your mystery evaporate like your presence in the night?
That was Night Winged by Helen Ball. A huge thanks to Helen for creating that beautiful piece. You can find her online. We've put the links in the show notes. If you've got a piece of writing or poetry that you'd like to share with us, drop us an email to the address in the show notes, and you never know, it might be featured on a future episode. Now, back to Bob's interview.
What do you think we can do to inspire the next generation of young bat workers? Because they are the future, aren't they?
Yes, well, quite so. The reason I dropped out of bat work was because I didn't have the energy anymore, and it takes a lot of energy to fight politicians and things like that. And it's not up to me. I'm old, and it's up to young people. It's their earth now. And, okay, young people will make some mistakes like we all did in the past, but it's their world, and they're the people who will be seeing changes now and will have to go forth and work with politicians, because it's still politicians who are the key.
So this is going to be a difficult question, given you've done bat work for the last 70 years. What's been your most notable or favourite memory of working with bats, or a particular bat species?
Oh, golly. Well, I shouldn't say this. I'm supposed to be a scientist. I think they're just beautiful animals, incredible animals. Yeah, and they've given me a living, for heaven's sake, which, well, it can't be bad for me. but no, I've had a lot in captivity for, I mean, some I had in captivity, individuals for years. And, I mean, these were injured animals, nearly all of them. And they were just sort of tremendously interesting animals to have around, very intelligent, resourceful. And at this moment, I'm just picturing the maybe people hearing this, which may remember a bat called Henry that we had, which was a long-eared bat with one wing. And I can picture it now. We were feeding it on the kitchen table, as we often did, and it was a slippery surface on the table, and the bat came out of its cage to the food bowl, and it slipped on the sort of formica surface. And we all laughed, and it looked at us with its wide eyes. What do you do that for? You know, kind of expression. It was, and I can picture it now. That's stuck with me for, oh, that was go back 30 years.
Hmm.
But, yeah, they've all got individual characters. And I think that's the other thing that people should remember. They are all individuals, even though they live in colonies. And it's important for them to live in colonies because of the way in which they can exchange information amongst each other and tell each other where the best places to feed are and all that sort of thing. But they're all individuals, and you've got nice ones and nasty ones and vindictive ones and just very pleasant ones in the same colony, just like humans.
What message would you give to everyone listening now who is involved in bat conservation? If this is your one chance to get a message out there, what would it be?
Well, in all the broadcasting I did in the 60s and 70s particularly, the only message I ever wanted to put over was that bats are beautiful creatures that need our protection. because they ain't going to get it from anywhere else. And they give so much delight to backgroup members all over the country, people who have them in their own houses. Often nowadays, they love to see them, like swallows coming back in the spring and that sort of thing. And people really do get real delight over watching these fascinating animals flying around at night, wondering how they're finding their way around. But there's so much we still don't know about them, and people should continue to marvel over these beautiful animals.
Nice answer. I'm just going to go back a little bit. When you were mentioning the enthusiasts and checking all the different research, and you said there wasn't that much research out there. And, you know, I've got the book. this is the book that Dad brought home from his place of work when I was getting into bats by you. Which bat is it? Published by the Mammal Society.
Yes.
How much work went into this, and how did you even get started in creating this dichotomous ID key?
Oh, when I first became interested in bats in the early 1950s, there were no keys on how to identify bats that were published. And I used to get all the books I could find, encyclopedias which had photographs of bats. Many of the bats that were in these books were dead specimens that was propped up on a branch or something to make it look as if they were alive. There was very little literature about, well, just how to identify them. My sort of interest in developing that first publication was that, well, I found it difficult. I wanted to make it easier for people coming along to identify them, because the whole thing about natural history is the first principles are you want to identify the species you're looking at. It doesn't matter what kind of animals or plants, you want a key. And so I developed that and sent it round to all the people I knew at the time and said, have a look at this and see what you think, and have I left anything out, or could anything be improved, which is how that happened. And yes, it's got a Lithuciscus pipistrelle on the cover, which was the one from 1969 in Dorset.
That is it?
That is the actual bat, yes. And we had it in captivity for about 3 days, I think, before it got released back to where it was found. I mean, it took us that long to identify it. Well, to be sure, we were looking at that specimen. Yeah, so it was so important that I thought that was the first thing I needed to publish. And then it's been updated once or twice since, and with a little bit more on echolocation and things like that. But this was really for the field naturalist, someone who finds a bat. I mean, so often there were some very notable naturalists of the past sent me specimens which they had incorrectly identified. And so even amongst people who you would think would know better got the identities wrong, which is why that was produced. And then as a result of that, I got involved in archaeological digs in a number of places. And what I had developed was a whole collection of every species of bat dismembered into individual bones. And so even tiny fragments of bones can be identified to species, but I haven't got a key for it. My only key is boxes and bottles with all the specimens to compare with, but it needs a key producing.
There you go. That's a challenge out there for someone listening to do it.
Yes, well, I need to deposit all these bones somewhere to some good cause at some stage.
And over the years, you've been involved with Bat Conservation Trust to varying degrees. What do you think the Bat Conservation Trust does best?
Well, publicity is probably the best thing. We still need as much publicity for bats as we can get. I mean, okay, they do appear, but I was looking at a journal the other day which came from the Zoological Society of London. And it's intended for kids, this magazine. And they're talking about, you know, turtles, lizards, antelope, gorillas. not a mention of a bat anywhere. You know, and after all, you know, a quarter or more of all mammals on Earth are bats, and we still don't get enough mention. And it should be much more out there. And again, I think that is still the most important thing that all bat group members can do, is promote bats in every possibility. Local newspapers, you know, just talk to journalists. I mean, journalists are always desperate for any sort of copy. And, you know, I used to phone them up regularly in national newspapers and whatever, and you're bound to get an article the next day, which for many newspapers would, if you're careful in what you say, would come out accurately.
Were you the person that invented the bat box? Because you did that publication, didn't you, from the work that you did in Thetford?
It was invented, quote unquote, 18 blah, 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 something or other by a Frenchman.
Hmm.
The concept of putting in a box just for bats. I was the first person in Britain to, if you like, develop the idea that all bats needed was just a space to form a cluster in Britain, being Britain's weather. You know, they need to be warm a lot of the time. And also, they had a thing about placing them high as being the only places that bats would use. So I built these first ones. I didn't have a ladder, so I put them on pine trees on a nature reserve, well, with three different places, but mostly on a nature reserve, which is Morden National Nature Reserve, just north of Wareham in Dorset. And I put them as high as I could reach, and I also put some about 2 foot off the ground.
Hmm.
All of them were used, whatever height. And I thought, I made nice, simple boxes, just, well, crude self, more or less square box. And then I thought, oh, that's right. Then we were getting a lot of publicity from bat boxes and bats generally. And a chap called Ron Webster, who was a producer of natural history items for the Tonight programme with Cliff Mitchell-Moore. Do you have heard of Cliff? Long before you were born.
Yeah, sorry.
he phoned up that they had sponsor a duck, and they'd got thousands of people sponsoring a duck. And MacDonald Hobley, a name you won't remember or know either, he was the anchorman newsreader for the BBC on BBC One. Anyway, this Ron Webster said, can we do a sponsor of bat? And I thought about it a bit and thought, oh, I don't know, what can we do, sponsor? Oh, we could sponsor bat boxes. Yeah, let's try that. We might get the odd 100 people sponsoring or something. So we went down to Dorset, and with the film crew, and we filmed these few boxes that I'd put on these pine trees 10 years before. And it was in February, I think. It was in the winter. The day wasn't particularly cold, but it wasn't warm either. And so we've got a bat box, cameraman set up, sort of, you know, walk up to the box, lift the lid, put the lid down, and come away. You know, all arranged. So walked up, lifted the lid, put it down, and the cameraman said, hey, there's a bat in there. I wasn't expecting a bat in the winter because I'd never looked at them in the midwinter at that time. And sure enough, it was a long-eared bat that was hanging on the underside or had a ring on it. And so anyway, we had that film. We showed it one evening at sort of 6:30. The programme used to run from 6 till 7, called the Nationwide. And it was watched by a good proportion of the whole country. Anyway, we said, sponsor a box for £7.50, I think it was. And I said, oh, well, we'll be able to put the boxes up close to where you are. You know, you won't go and see them, but we'll get them in a bit of forest close to the sponsor. Anyway, we had over 3,000 boxes sponsored. most of the sponsors were residents of London. And, well, the long short of it is, with the aid of the Forestry Commission, we so chose six, this was going to be run as a proper experiment. We chose six forests, Ardross Forest, north of Inverness, Kilda Forest on the England-Scottish border, Cannock Forest in the Midlands, Thetford Forest in Norfolk, Wareham Forest in Dorset, and Yateley Forest near Blackbush Airport. And we were going to put 60 boxes, no, 60 trees had eight boxes each. So a tree would have four at 5 metres high, another four at 3 metres high, so we could see whether they prefer to be north, south, east and west, and whether they prefer higher or lower ones. All the same type of box, all made by a disabled manufacturing company. So we had these boxes, and they got put up in the autumn of 1975. And, of course, I had to write a newsletter sent out to all these people, so I had to have a secretary to keep in touch with over 3,000 people. And, of course, nearly all the boxes sponsored by Londoners put them all up in Ardross Forest, north of Inverness. So we had an awful lot of disgruntled people. And the trees in Ardross Forest were planted in 1896, before the commission was started, which wasn't started until after the First World War. And some of the trees were about that diameter, so you couldn't actually put four boxes around at the same height. They had to be staggered. But the trees also would lean like that when you put the ladder up against them. And being on top of a hill, often a gale blowing. Anyway, we did learn a lot from that. And I used to do all the boxes in 1 week. I'd drive up on a Sunday night to northwest Scotland, stay with a friend in the Nature Conservancy. Anyway, it was 2,300 miles in the week, plus 6 days running up and down 60 trees and carrying ladders. It was, you know, I mean, in those days, it was no effort because I was young and strong. And that went on until 1985. We did it for 10 years. And then quite a lot of them were then taken over by local back groups who carried on doing them. So we did discover, basically, that bats prefer to be higher rather than lower, but we'll still use them. And they use different aspects at different times, depending on what the weather's doing, what the season's doing. So basically, that's why we came up with the general principle of putting up three boxes, north, south, west, south, east, on a single tree. So three boxes per tree. Because you also find that when a box, say you've got a strong morning sun on a southeast box, may get too hot. So the bats just move around the tree during the day. Whereas if you have one box on a tree, if it gets too hot, then they've got to come out, fly, and get caught by a sparrowhawk on the way.
Yeah.
Which I've seen bats caught by sparrowhawks on a number of occasions, and by hobby. So that's how the general concept of putting these boxes up. I mean, I know there are so many different shapes and designs, and bats will use almost anything, anywhere, anytime. But it was the general principle of doing experiments, which nobody, all these thousands, hundreds of thousands of boxes in Russia, no one had done any actual experiments to determine what the preferences were for bats. They just put them up.
Great stuff. Dr. Bob Stebbins, it's been an honour talking to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure memorising, remembering stuff that I did a long time ago.
Thank you to Bob for sitting down with me. It was a real joy listening to all of Bob's stories about the history of bat conservation here in the UK. As you've heard throughout this series, bats are magical but misunderstood mammals. Here at the Bat Conservation Trust, we have a vision of a world rich in wildlife where bats and people thrive together. We know that conservation action to protect and conserve bats is having a positive impact on bat populations here in the UK. We wouldn't be able to continue our work to protect bats and their habitats without your contribution. So if you can, please donate. We need your support now more than ever. You can donate by following the link at the bottom of the show notes of any episode. Thank you. And that brings us to the end of Series 4 of Bat Chat. I really hope you've enjoyed listening to all of our guests this series and the bat conservation stories being told. It really helps us as a show if you leave us a review about Bat Chat, either in a podcast app or on social media. Instructions of how to leave a review are in the show notes, and you can tag us on social media using the hashtag BatsChat. With Bat Chat, we're reaching out to lovers of bats all over the world. So if you know someone who's never listened to a podcast before, we'd love it if you could show them how to listen and how to find Bat Chat. Now, I mentioned at the start of the show that we had some news for you. We're finishing this series slightly earlier than usual, but we have a couple of bonus episodes for you, which will be released before the start of the next series. So make sure you tap that follow button so that when those episodes land, you'll get a notification straight away. The first of those bonus episodes is about the upcoming landmark nature documentary series, Wild Isles. Narrated by Sir David Attenborough, this major five-part natural history series from Silverback Films is coming to BBC One and iPlayer this year, and we have an interview with the Silverback team about that series for you as a bonus episode. You can watch the Wild Isles trailer in the show notes. Recording for Series 5 of Bat Chat is already underway and will be coming later in the year. We're looking for participants to share bat stories from across the UK with the podcast, so if you're working on a great project or have a story about the bats in your area, please drop us an email to the address in the show notes. We hope you all have a fantastic summer getting out there and enjoy seeing bats in the night sky. Bat Chat is an original podcast from the Bat Conservation Trust. The series producer and editor was me, Steve Rowe, and I need to give a huge thanks to all of my guests this series, because without them this show wouldn't happen, and to the communications team at BCT, Joe Nunes-Mino and Andrea Correa da Costa, for their fabulous work and support in promoting us on social media and linking to the episodes on the BCT website. And of course, without you listening to us, there wouldn't be any point in producing the show. So a huge thanks to you guys, our listeners, for your ongoing support of the show. Now, lots of you have seen me in branded t-shirts and hoodies with the Bat Chat logo on, and you've all been asking me when they'll be available. Well, we're thrilled to let you know that a whole range of Bat Chat clothing and tote bags is now available for you on our T-Mill store, the link's in the show notes. Whether you're a long-time supporter or a new member of the Bat Chat family, we can't wait for you to share your photos of you wearing our merch on social media. Be sure to tag the Bat Conservation Trust in your posts. If you're listening to Bat Chat on Google Podcasts, we wanted to let you know that Google have announced they plan to discontinue their app later this year, so we recommend making the switch to an alternative podcast app, and we've put some links in the show notes to alternative apps that you can follow Bat Chat on so that you don't miss any future episodes.